rather than park and then walk to the grocery store, I did a rare move and decided to drive into the parking lot. There's probably room for 35 cars or so in the front of the store. So I pull in and I pull around a corner that's right next to the front of the store where people are picking up their shopping carts. There's just barely enough room for the vehicle to pass through. And I'm trying to go through being very careful because there's a lot of people there and there's cars coming from the other part of the parking lot. And I just had this aha moment. I'm sitting in this 7-seater car. I'm trying to get around and then park my car so that I can walk into the store and buy maybe 8 things that will fit into one grocery bag and drive 3 blocks home. It was definitely an aha moment. I thought, this is an absolutely ridiculous vehicle to be using for this purpose.
Meet Dan Lusher, cyclist, drummer, engineer, San Francisco resident, trail runner, and urban planning enthusiast.
Starting in college, I was really interested in environmental issues, and this was in the 1980s when climate change was slightly on the radar, but most people weren't really thinking about it. Air pollution was incredibly bad in California, where I grew up and I lived most of my life. I was very motivated to do something about creating environmental change. And so I got more and more involved and interested in the linkage between vehicles and air pollution and finding ways to make our cities or have our cities be less built around the car and specifically designed to accommodate the car.
I remember from the 90s, there used to be this computer game, SimCity, I think it was called. And I remember playing that, and one of the problems that you always encountered when I was building my city, that after a while, if I built too many roads, there would be smog. And it was always my city would start shrinking then because people would start leaving it. That computer game, it did resonate with me.
They did. I've read that they did a lot of research. They became sort of mini urbanists when they developed that game. They read a lot of research that was up to date at the time, and so that effect is quite accurate.
Did you play that by any chance?
I did. I loved it. The difference, of course, is there's only one decision maker. You can effectively play God in that game. And real cities are much more complicated in terms of getting things done and making change.
Conflicting interests might have always played a role in shaping the face of modern urban development in some way or another, but in recent years, they've taken an unlikely and dark turn.
I saw a few emails come in through that web form in quick succession that had to do with 15-minute prisons and you're awful and you're scum and I don't want you to dominate the world, something along those lines. And I had no idea where that was coming from. So that's when I was first introduced to the conspiracy theories. And then, of course, I had to go down the rabbit hole to learn more.
Welcome to Living Planet. I'm Neil King. And in this episode, we're going to be exploring what are known as 15-minute cities.
I mean, I personally live in a 15-minute city in San Francisco, and I love it.
You might also know them as walkable cities or even 20-minute cities. They all translate to pretty much the same concept, and they're meeting a lot of unexpected pushback. So what exactly are they?
To me, a 15-minute city is a city whose residents can access most of their needs within a 15-minute walk or bike ride from their home. It's that simple.
Put like that, it does sound simple, positively benign. Yet, as we've just heard, this innocuous-sounding idea has faced backlash and unleashed conspiracy theories. We'll dig deeper into them in a little while, but first, let's go back to the beginning. The The 15-minute city concept is the work of scientist Carlos Moreno. He's a Colombian-born professor at the Sorbonne University in Paris and expert in complex systems. Over two decades ago, he starts exploring how to rethink car-based urban living. Cities take up no more than 4% of the landmass on the planet, but more than half the world's population live in them. Urban areas are responsible for an estimated 70% of global CO2 emissions. And those emissions are driving the climate change that is connected to increasing extreme weather events around the world. Moreno sees the potential for reducing the carbon footprint of cities by addressing things like transport and infrastructure. Initially, he's just sharing with peers, but his ideas soon begin to ripple out further. And for some people, they are immediately relatable.
In late 2019, I was looking for a way to become a more formal part of the conversation around walkable cities and making cities better and less car dependent. And I looked around for, you know, good concepts that I thought were aligned with how I wanted to see cities change. I wanted to look at, you know, are people talking about 15-minute cities on Instagram and Twitter and, you know, on the various social media channels? And so I would look at hashtag 15-minute city, and there was very little activity. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity to start talking about walkable cities using this 15-minute city frame. So I set up a website, I set up an Instagram, I set up a Twitter account, and started using the 15-minute city hashtag.
So you've got the domain 15minutecity.com. You were the first to snag that. And were you surprised yourself that it hadn't been taken yet?
At the time, not really, because it was a relatively obscure concept. I mean, Carlos Moreno had been talking about it, I think, using that particular phrase since 2016. But it was within pretty specific academic circles.
When you first started blogging, was there a lot of interest to begin with?
It was a relatively small audience at the beginning.
It's 2020, and Dan's biking and walking about San Francisco, writing and posting about the potential benefits of others getting around in the same way. He's excited about the ideas he's found via Carlos Moreno, about the potential climate benefits of reducing car traffic within cities, of offering residents greater choice. In fact, he's just happy to be part of the conversation. And it's all pretty quiet and easygoing. But then, something changes.
L'immense bonheur de proclamer Anne Hidalgo maire de Paris.
Ce choix, vous le confirmez aujourd'hui. Ce choix m'honore.
The mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, is re-elected following a campaign to turn the French capital into a 15-minute city. She wants to make each little district or arrondissement more self-sufficient. She wants them to have public green space, grocery shops, restaurants and cafes, education, sporting and health facilities. In short, she wants to transform Paris into a place where everything locals need can be found within 15 minutes of their home, all accessible with a short bike ride or walk. The plan is celebrated by some as a win for Paris and the climate. But it also coincides with controversial COVID lockdowns.
The breaking news, stay at home. That is the order tonight from four state governors as the coronavirus pandemic.
As COVID-19 cases continue to surge across the country.
Frustrated about restrictions on personal freedoms, some interpret the 15-minute city idea as another way of controlling movement.
So there was legitimate concern over the lockdowns. There was harm to economic livelihoods, and I think that got conflated.
Given that the last thing most people want during the COVID era is further restriction, the misinformation doing the rounds hits a nerve, and it spreads. It's around that time that Dan starts to receive negative remarks in response to what he is posting about 15-minute cities.
Concentration camps for the New World Order agenda.
Take out all and any infrastructure you see before it's too late and we become 15-minute city prisoners.
Trying to control every aspect of life.
Authoritarianism in action.
NWO control agenda.
No, thank you.
There'd be just sort of random comments. Somebody would say, oh, this is a great idea. I hope 15-minute cities come to my town. And the next comment would be something like 15-minute prison. Or no one would just walk in a cattle car willingly. And things like that. But then there were some that got more personal. Like there was one person that posted on Instagram, nice plans. We are all hoping you will die before it gets realized.
Is that something you just shrug it off? Or does it start to get under your skin?
Honestly, I disregarded the whole thing or tried to for a few months until I saw that it was actually changing the discourse. I would say that's where it started to get me mad, not when they were attacking me. And to be clear, like what I experienced was nothing compared to what Professor Carlos Moreno has had to face. You know, he's received hundreds of death threats.
Even years after the lockdowns, the conversation around 15-minute cities is still rife with misinformation. So what else is driving the negative narrative? One thing that gets emotions flowing is cars. That great tin can beacon of personal freedom. One common falsehood doing the rounds is that a 15-minute city means zero cars. But does it?
It does not. Cars play a valuable role. I own a car. I love cars. They are not good for being the primary mode of transportation inside cities, particularly dense cities. Inside cities, they can be a mix in certain circumstances, but the problem we have, particularly in America, but many other places as well, is people being in a position where they're dependent upon the car, and using a car is really their only choice. And that's really what the 15-minute city is about, not eliminating cars, but making sure that people have choices.
And not all city dwellers even want their own car. The reasons vary, but research has found US citizens who rely on a car for more than 50% of out-of-home activities experience lower life satisfaction. Also, that 40% of Americans would rather live in denser communities with walking distance of amenities. Then there's the money, because cars aren't cheap. In fact, they cost an average of between $9,000 and $12,000 a year to run. So it's not about forcing people out of their vehicles, but about making cities enjoyable to walk and bike around, at least for those who want to.
The 15-minute city is a new label on a very, very old concept. I would argue that before the invention of the car, almost all cities were 15-minute cities because people had to access what they needed mostly on foot. Sometimes on horseback in the old days in rural areas, but mostly on foot in cities. So this is a new way to describe an old way of living, essentially.
Is that maybe also one of the reasons why it triggers such emotion in certain people, the fact that the message that they might hear is it goes back. You're going back to times before. Sort of not progress, but regressing. Is that maybe why it gets so many people riled up?
I don't, that's possible. I mean, I think most of the pushback has really been framed around these conspiracy theories, which have got it all wrong and seem to believe that the 15-minute city is about removing choice, when in fact it's about expanding choice.
But beyond the conspiracy theories, there are also some legitimate concerns about the potential downsides. One is that if you encourage people to spend their time in their own neighborhood, it can impact their ability to move up the socioeconomic ladder.
People in poor neighborhoods need access to wealthier neighborhoods to see what's possible, to find opportunities, etc. And that's why the 15-minute city within neighborhoods really needs to be supplemented by strong public transit and other ways for people to get between neighborhoods. The second legitimate point of contention is gentrification and displacement. So right now, the demand for walkable neighborhoods in the United States exceeds the actual supply of those neighborhoods by about a factor of 4 to 1. So when you change a neighborhood, make it more walkable and bikeable, that right now, under the current circumstances of supply-demand imbalance, that right now almost invariably causes land and real estate prices to increase in that neighborhood. And that can lead to displacement.
The solution, as far as Dan is concerned, is not to skimp on redevelopment, but to go big, to build hundreds of walkable neighbourhoods that would absorb the demand and prevent the gentrification and scarcity effect. But it's easier said than done, because in many parts of the US at least, tight zoning restrictions are hampering grand-scale transformation.
Broadly speaking, 75 to 80% of land in cities is zoned in a way that the property owner can only build a single family detached home, which in the land of the free is quite curious that we have restricted things in such a way.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, why? What's the reasoning behind that?
Zoning in general started out as a way to make sure people didn't live next to smoky factories, right? That was the idea originally, was to separate incompatible uses. But it was pretty quickly in the U.S. context began to be used to separate people along socioeconomic and racial lines. So you would have neighborhoods, they could have additional requirements. For example, you had to spend a certain amount of money on your home. And so that effectively excluded people who didn't have certain socioeconomic means. So that's how zoning quickly came to be an instrument of division and exclusion in the United States.
Dan says other side effects have been a mix of very tall buildings in condensed downtown areas that can be built on, urban sprawl that can see housing pushed out into fire risk areas, and an erosion of walkable communities.
People build out because they can't build up. And this is why in the US, you know, and you say, you couldn't build high rises, you couldn't even build mid rises. Europe does perfectly well with 4, 5, and 6-story buildings for miles. Berlin, Milan, many other cities are amazing at having these sort of mid-rise buildings, and you don't see the need for these 50-story buildings like you do in the U.S.
So is it time to introduce Paris, Barcelona, or Munich-style mid-rise blocks with retail on the ground floor and maybe 10 residential units above into certain areas of certain willing US cities? An LA-based grassroots group that Dan advises is working along those lines.
It's my favorite example of a bottom-up 15-minute city effort. It's a group of activists in Los Angeles that are wanting to create change, that are wanting to make very car-oriented Los Angeles more pleasant, more walkable, safer for pedestrians.
People covet this. It's very aspirational to live where you can walk. Our bodies crave 30 to 60 minutes of exercise every day. As you age, you really need to stay active. I'm learning this. Biking is the magic pill. It cuts cancer and heart disease in half. But you don't even need to think about biking. You just think about walking.
Avid cyclist Lindsay Sturman grew up in what she describes as a tiny shoebox apartment in New York. Her street had shops at ground level and housing on the upper floors. So, to all intents and purposes, a 15-minute city. And when she moves to LA to pursue her career as a TV writer, she can still get anywhere within 20 minutes. But over time, like many places, the city changes. And when COVID strikes, one shift in particular becomes too visible to ignore. She starts noticing tents and encampments.
We call it the crisis of our unhoused neighbors, the homeless crisis.
She gets together with other locals, seeking to understand how things have got so bad and what it will take to fix them.
Why do we have this homeless crisis when so many other cities don't?
And as the largely voluntary group, which calls itself the Livable Communities Initiative, or LCI, starts to peel back the layers of the problem, something unexpected comes to light.
It's just the cars, actually.
Cars again. For context, there are more than 6 million cars registered in LA County, which is home to around 10 million people.
Los Angeles is over capacity for cars for hours every day. We're sort of almost in gridlock at this point. Think of a road as a tube, but it's a metal tube. It's not rubber. It's not going to stretch. And we all know induced demand. You can't add lanes of traffic and fix traffic. It just makes it worse because you induce people to use it. When the only thing that keeps people home is when the traffic's so bad, they just delay their trip. So traffic's the only thing that stops traffic. Because there's another thing is that people say, well, what if we speed up the cars? Can we get more cars through the system, right? Can we push this fluid math? Well, it turns out you can, because we have something called the 2-second rule, which is you drive about 2 seconds behind the car in front of you. So if you're going 70 miles an hour, you actually stagger a lot more because you don't want to hit the car if they stop short. And at, 10 miles an hour, you can be right behind that car. So it turns out you can't speed up the cars because you get the exact same capacity of cars through that tube. So cars just don't fit geometrically. The math doesn't work for cars in cities. So you just end up with traffic.
But it's not only about keeping cars moving, a side effect of which are the planet heating emissions that make them a major contributor to cities' overall CO2 footprint. It's also about where to park them.
Here's where it all connects. Parking ruins housing. Parking makes housing expensive. Parking distorts the architecture. And it does so many terrible things. It not just raises rent, but it also raises the cost of building. So that's where we got our housing crisis, is that forcing parking into buildings.
To recap, if residents of a city can only do their grocery shopping by car, they need a car. If they need a car, they need somewhere to put it. If that need has to be included in architectural design, it greatly impacts what can be built.
And the answer to how do you build affordable housing without subsidies, because we just don't have enough of them, is that you build a small apartment above a shop. You build a small apartment behind a shop. And there's no parking, but then you need mobility. The real solution is to go back to what the city was historically. The modern city of LA was, it was little neighborhoods, little villages with little main streets. And then these villages were connected by the world's biggest trolley system, the Red Line system, which is made famous in the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So we had the biggest trolley system in the world. But what it really just did was connected little neighborhoods. And they were these little walkable neighborhoods. And that's our history. And they all exist. The tracks are gone, most of them. But the neighborhoods are still there. And we actually have a metro system connecting a lot of them. So the pitch that we give for LA is, let's just build a lot of housing in these little walkable neighborhoods, and you can actually solve a ton of things at the same time.
Things such as boosting health by getting people moving, promoting human interaction and community building, which is linked to a reduction in loneliness and dementia, and responding to the climate crisis.
The climate emergency is at our door. It's come.
So for Lindsay and her colleagues, it's not only about reducing traffic, it's also about building climate-friendly homes.
They're courtyard buildings, they're residential over retail, and you have an elevator with a staircase that wraps around it usually, and you have four apartments on each floor, sometimes two. So that's your classic building, and you can build to not need AC. And we, of course, know this because we've been building housing for hundreds of years before AC, so we know it's possible.
Only where to begin in a city so dependent on cars? Contrary to some conspiracy theories that have emerged in the wake of the LA fires, the idea is not to build new neighbourhoods from scratch, but to transform existing, currently unwalkable multi-lane streets with low-rise buildings on either side into areas with both residential and retail appeal.
Okay. Lindsay, I'm just going to pull up your website, thelivablecommunitiesinitiative.com, because I was looking at some pictures that you've got here. And just right at the top, you've got the sentence saying, imagine this. You've got a picture of a very well, it's a very depressing street. Even the weather's bad, right? It's like dark storm clouds and single story sort of little shops. It is quite bleak. And on the right hand side, it's like a Photoshop picture, right? It's a design picture. It's drawn almost, right? Or what are these pictures? Where are they from?
Yeah, so we reimagined a street because it was really hard when we were doing it. It was really hard for us to imagine, well, what could it look like? And the biggest change, other than there's housing, right, is in the trees. That's what catches your eye. But is that the street has gone from 6 or 7 lanes to one lane of cars in each direction going 10 miles an hour.
So just looking at these pictures, for me, the deduction there would be you're suggesting, okay, away from single-story buildings, you know, build a bit higher, maybe 3 or 4 stories, have the shops at the bottom, create a nice little pedestrian area, a bike lane, and reduce the number of lanes for the cars, and a bit of greenery.
Yes, that's the recipe. LA, to their credit, has created a step-by-step off-the-shelf plan to do LCI. It's part of our city's plans to build housing.
Moving the project from the planning to implementation phase will require a positive vote from the city council. Lindsay is hopeful that will happen. The next challenge will be to convince lot owners to build on their land.
Most streets, commercial streets in LA, have 20 parcels, 10 on one side, 10 on the other. And you might have 17 different owners. And they live all over the world. And they're not big, you know, they're just regular people who happen to maybe have inherited something or they bought it, you know, as an investment. And to get them to get organized or sell, they won't sell and they're not going to get organized. So what you really need to do is persuade them to build. But you ask them to build stuff that's affordable.
So what's in it for the lot owners? According to the LCI team, low risk and profit. And they have come up with standard architectural plans to minimize complications and help convince them to get on board. So far, Lindsay and her colleagues have presented the concept to more than 5,000 people, many of whom, she says, come along with a not-in-my-backyard attitude. But once they hear the idea, the resistance drops.
I can count on 2 hands the number of people who did not come on side. That people understand it, they want it, they want walkability. The number one request to the city of Beverly Hills is more walkable streets. The number one driver of a real estate value and how much people want to buy into a neighborhood is walkability. It's called the walk score. We've all, you know, been to cities or neighborhoods that were walkable. We love them. Disneyland, we love walkable neighborhoods. So I think it's a deep desire for people.
For all the red tape and misinformation, there is momentum in the 15-minute movement. Cleveland's mayor, Justin Bibb, is embracing the framework for his city. He says it meets many of his goals, including improving air quality, public health and housing options, and decarbonizing as a response to climate change. Other cities around the world are working on similar concepts. Barcelona has introduced a large low-emissions zone, and Melbourne is aiming for a 10% reduction in CO2 emissions through increased walkability and cyclability. Having this kind of choice remains pivotal for Dan in the context of US cities and the American dream of freedom.
The American dream is not driving 2 blocks to the grocery store. We need a lot of people to be walking and biking. If the American dream leads us into some sort of, you know, environmental catastrophe and unlivable cities, that's not very dreamlike to me.
This episode of Living Planet was produced by Tamsin Walker and edited by me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Gert Georgi. Living Planet is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. What did you think of this episode? We'd love to hear your thoughts, so please do send us a message. Our email address is livingplanet@dw.com. Of course, you can also leave a rating or review on the podcast platform of your choice. Living Planet is produced by DW in Bonn, Germany.
Before you go, we've got a podcast recommendation for you. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast. Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world today. Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming. Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution. A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.